Hello and welcome. Dr. Paul Bennett is my first guest for you today. He's a podiatrist, a forensic podiatrist. A podiatrist is, as you probably know, a doctor that specialises in the bones, the muscle and skin of the foot. And what Paul knows from doing this for so many years is that the foot tells stories about the individual that's attached to it. And the footprint that it leaves behind can reveal so much about a person's weight, perhaps their heights, the way they walk and move, and maybe whether they're carrying something heavy. And this is why the police come to Paul to act as a forensic podiatrist, to decode evidence from a crime scene, to look at a shoe or a footprint cast that might be full of information. Hello, Paul.
Hello, Richard. Thank you very much for inviting me on.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure, sir. Tell me about, let's start with the first police case you were brought in on. What were you doing when the police came to you?
Sitting at my desk at the Queensland University of Technology, and the phone rang. And on the other end of the phone was Senior Detective Sergeant Brad Hall from Queensland Police Services, the Forensic Science Unit. And he said to me, Paul, I've got some evidence that we've recovered from a crime scene, and I've got some inked impressions of the individual. Do you think you may be able to have a look at these for us? And that started the process of a relationship which has now existed for some 15 years.
What can he tell you about the crime and what he brought this inked impression to you and all sorts of evidence to you? How did all that process start?
He told me nothing about the circumstance. Effectively, they came in and put the inked impressions on my desk and a pair of Dunlop Volley footwear.
So that's so you don't get prejudiced?
Correct.
Is that right?
That's right.
And so then what do you do once you've been given this evidence?
That process was to... It's a two-stage process. The first stage is really to look at the evidence and allow it to process through my mind. That can take hours to days to minutes. It really does depend on each individual circumstance. From that... I then look for pattern recognition in my mind as to what I'm actually looking at. What is the evidence really telling me? And in that particular case, the inked impressions, if you think of the ridge detail on your hands, there's a particular ridge detailing that occurs. And then I looked inside the Dunlop volleys. Then I went back to the inked impressions and then back to the Dunlop volleys. And I said to Brad, look, have you tried illuminating the inside of the footwear to look for DNA evidence or blood products? And he said, we hadn't even thought about it. And when I went back to the ink impression, there was a small area the size of a match head that was inconsistent in ridge detail. And I said, if you can go back to your footwear and illuminate it using luminol and ultraviolet light, see if you can find blood product.
So when you say it's an inconsistent, you mean it's like a little bump inside of it? You mean
it's an irregular pattern in a series of grooves and ridges. So there was an irregularity.
Right. So what happened when they did that?
They went and looked at the area, illuminated it, and inside the footwear found serous blood product. And they were able to extract by biopsy and assay that and identify the individual perpetrator's DNA through that process.
What was the thing that caused this irregularity, this little bump in the footwear?
A viral infection, which creates a vascular lesion in the epidermis of the skin. And so this is one part of the skin which will leak blood product.
So this is a wart, in other words.
Yeah, exactly.
This was a plantar wart, essentially.
Correct, yeah, exactly.
And you just see that from a little dent. And from that, you were able to get a DNA sample from a tiny little secretion of blood.
Correct.
Was that crucial in finding the person involved?
Absolutely. Yeah, that was able to confirm in the QPS, Queensland Police Services, mind, the perpetrator that they were dealing with.
What about the wear pattern of a shoe? What does that reveal to you?
The wear patterns are unique identifying characteristics about the individual's biomechanical function. So from everything, the way you move, the way your hips rotate, the way your knee flexes.
Sorry, the way your hip rotates shows up in your shoe wear?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, yeah. So there are multiple variables that combine to create a kinetic imprint of the individual. So, for example, this is the kind of things we train the university students in, is looking at what is the range of movement that occurs within a joint structure. What is the average and where do people sit on that continuum?
So when you're doing that and you're studying the wear pattern, You're getting a picture of how this person walks.
That's right. Visualization through visualization.
You're visualizing the walk, the actual gait of that person.
Yeah, and I can slow this down in my mind. I can slow it down so it becomes like a slow motion movie.
How personalized is that? How specific is the way we walk?
Highly. Yeah, very really? Much so. Yeah, very much so.
Like it's not a fingerprint, is it? But it's nonetheless, it does point to specific individuals?
Absolutely. Your body's a multivariate interactive model. So there's multiple variables from body weight through to the speed that you're actually moving, through to habitual behaviour, through to injury. All of those variables go into the equation.
I'm just glad I'm sitting down right now. If I was walking, I'd be feeling really conspicuous.
Unlike some of the people we've prosecuted where they've actually examined their feet in the dock.
In the dock?
Yes, they've pulled their shoes off, put them on the dock and looked at their feet with absolute fascination.
This has happened. This is something you've seen, and you've been asked to comment on a foot in the dock.
Yes. Yeah, the accused was there and wanting to understand what was actually going on with them.
Can you not help noticing things about the way people walk when they walk past you? Do you do a quick sketch of an individual when you meet them for the way they walk and the way they stand?
It depends how interesting the individual is. So I filter out most of what goes on, but certainly people with... variances go into my mental database. So absolutely, yes.
Tell me more about this mental state you place yourself in to absorb the evidence that's been brought to you.
That's a really good question, and I had to give that some thought and think about what really forensic science is all about. And the forensic component of this is really the information that's put in front of you from a crime scene. It's the evidence. It's the start point for the mental process. And often, as I mentioned previously, it has to sit in your conscious, but then filter to your subconscious as to its relevance. So that's the sifting and sorting process. Once you develop a mental picture of what's actually occurring with regard to the evidence, it's then my responsibility to go to the science, hence forensic and science, and then bring the scientific analysis to that component. So let me give you a little bit of an example here. Going back to the Veruca case...
The plantar wart case.
That's right. Yeah. Yes. I was recently down at Mona, the art gallery in Tasmania, and it was a forensic science symposium, and there were maybe 300 forensic science officers wandering around the gallery. And I noticed a young boy in a black T-shirt and black pants, was obviously an art student, but that qualified him to be the bouncer. And I asked him, as I was looking over, I said, look, that looks like a Picasso. It looks like the Weeping Woman. And he said, it is. I said, you're kidding. It's not a copy. No, it's the original. He said, it's insured for $30 million. I said, so can you show me actually the best piece of artwork you've got here? And he took me off to see a Kandinsky. And I stood in front of this piece of art. If people, listeners are there, they can Google this. Spelt K-A-N-D-I-N-S-K-Y, Kandinsky. And the artwork was overwhelming. There was this real resonance at an emotional level and at an intellectual level in terms of the properties of the artwork.
This is a bit of abstract expressionism, also.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Right. And I studied the painting in great detail, and there were literally hundreds of parallel lines going in different orientation. But there were only three lines in the actual piece of artwork which were non-parallel. So in looking at the art, I was able to focus in on the key delineating feature of that piece of art. Now, most people were walking back and past that piece of artwork and paying absolutely no attention to it whatsoever. And so the mental imaging process is part, the very first part of the analysis.
And did it strike you that this is a similar process to... the way you like to examine evidence?
That's exactly the case.
So when you, as you say that, I think that a painting is able to tell a story, but not in the way we're telling stories now, where it doesn't really move through time in the same way. All the elements are there in a single moment on the canvas. And it's a similar thing for you, I suppose. You have to extract from that a narrative from this one artifact, which is like a painting, I suppose.
That's exactly the situation. And when I did a little bit of research on why my processes were like that, it became apparent even earlier in my childhood at age 10, 11, 12. I was quite disruptive at school and never really paying attention. And so my mother, my beautiful mother, took me to a child psychologist, and I was assessed there, and they basically said, oh, listen, your son could qualify for Mensa and he'll ultimately end up somewhere in a university. But that didn't stop my behaviour, my kind of disruptive behaviour in schooling, and I never read, I never studied or anything, but was able to get good marks all the way through. And it's really that process of looking at things and problem solving through things like Mensa. It's actually an association of people that really love solving puzzles. And that's really what this forensic process is about.
Does it require you let the unconscious mind run rampant for a while, and that's why you like to leave it for a bit, think about it, study it, and lose yourself a little bit?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's intense periods of concentration and focusing, for me anyway, it seems to go deep into the subconscious.
Tell me about a cold case in Sydney that the police asked you to help them with that involved a dead teenager. Let's start with the incident itself. How had this teenager been killed?
A young boy had been drinking at a bar in Sydney. This is about 10, 15 years ago. And they left the bar on a Sunday evening. And he was walking through the streets. And he was accosted by some individuals. They chased him into an alleyway. And one of the individuals proceeded to kick him to death. And the boy was murdered at the scene. The perpetrator of the crime looked down and saw the boy had good footwear and stole the boy's shoes and put them on. The murderer then fled the crime scene with his shoes in his hands and threw the shoes onto an awning in a side street. This is 10 years ago. The next day, people working in the office block looked down on the awning and saw these shoes.
So the shoes on the awning were the killer's shoes?
They were the killer's shoes.
And he'd taken the victim's shoes to wear instead?
That's correct, yes. And these shoes then were analysed by New South Wales Forensic Science Unit, and three lots of DNA were extracted from the shoes. The victims, the perpetrators, and a third party. They sat in the DNA database for 10 years.
10 years, this was a cold case?
That's correct, 10 years.
What was the breakthrough?
I got a phone call from QPS saying, we have a suspect in Bowen, I think it was, and the individual had stolen a push bike after being out on the town. And that was a low enough threshold when the police discovered the push bike in the suspect's front yard to take his DNA sample. So they swabbed the inside of his cheek and bang, it went into the database and matched one of the DNA samples on the footwear from the crime.
So then they got his shoes again?
Yes. They then approached me and said, Paul, this case is a 10-year-old cold case and it's going to be heavily reliant on DNA evidence. We really need to have a look to see if there are other ways to corroborate. Now, this evidence, the footwear was extremely worn out, heavily worn. And so they brought the footwear into me and I went through that process of looking and reconstructing in my mind the individual's movement patterns to create those wear patterns. So that's the start process. And then I go through and build a profile and that's my initial report. Then they bring in various kinds of evidence to do match comparison with.
But I have to say, 10 years have gone by.
Yeah.
The person concerned has aged 10 years, may have had a back injury or a broken leg or something, and the way they carry themselves and walk might be quite different. How do you account for those kind of differences over 10 years?
They are really good questions, and you sound like a fabulous defence lawyer.
Because, <My Lord>.
Because they were the exact questions that were raised. And there, I had to go through the process for accounting for how age affects the gait cycle, the movement patterns.
There's research on that?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. How obesity impacts on load distributions and how footwear wears. So injury, for example. In this particular case, the individual in that 10-year period had been in a motor vehicle accident and had a broken knee. Now, you can imagine how that has the potential to influence an individual's gait and wear patterns. So I had to take account of that. But you have a thing called a preferred movement pathway. So that is programmed in your brain and that allows you to perform your tasks in a subconscious way. So in spite of him having those injuries, we were still able to replicate the wear patterns in the individual 10 years later.
So it's a tell, in other words. You have this preferred movement pathway, and that's the tell.
That's it. Exactly.
You've testified quite a few times in a courtroom. What's that like? Is it intimidating?
Look, I have a great respect for the judicial system in Queensland and around the country. I think it holds everybody accountable for their opinion. Certainly, when you're involved in forensics, you should be there and you should be rigorously cross-examined, much the way you are doing now.
Sure. This is matters of life and death. And you're brought in to bring evidence in on one side. It must be a quite intense experience.
It's intense in two levels. And this is the way I kind of describe it, is at the first level is I get a sense for what the crime is. And I make this kind of arbitrary division in my mind. There are crimes that are somewhat impulsive. So they can be crimes of passion where a spouse murders their partner, or a drunken act where somebody is randomly attacked. These are kind of random acts. The second kind of category of crime that I look at is what I describe as psychopathology. Psychological pathology is driving it.
Cold-blooded killing.
Yes.
For its own pleasure.
Absolutely. And that's a certain category of crimes that I've worked on. And the final category is really what I call organised crime, where there's a lot of calculated planning in the event. And they are the most nervous cases that I need to work on.
Do you ever look at the accused when you're in the dock? Well, not, you're not in the dock, in the witness stand, I beg your pardon.
Yes, occasionally. I will glance, but my mind is really deep in thought, not really to pay too much attention to who the individual is.
You worked on a case of a serial killer, Leonard John Fraser. Tell me how you were brought in on that, Paul.
Again, phone call. It was to do with the discovery of Keira Steinhardt's body, Rockhampton. The phone went and said, Paul, we've got a series of impressions, footprint impressions at the crime scene. And I'd worked on previous cases with Aboriginal trackers, and they taught me a lot about the science of interpretation. Not in scientific manner. They use much different ways to describe it. Anyway, we went through the process of looking at the various partial and complete footprints, and I was able to build a composite image of the individual that produced the prints. And we were able to narrow the probability to less than 0.15% of the population that actually had these particular pressure print impressions. So we received casts from the crime scene and went through the process of analysing those plus visual images of those to build a profile of the individual.
What could you tell from that footprint about how he was travelling?
He had in the front part of his foot one of the five metatarsals were slightly depressed or lowered. So they all sit on a transverse plane fairly evenly. One of the five metatarsals...
Are they the bones in your toes or in your foot?
In your foot itself? In the ball.
Right.
In the front underneath ball part. And one of these was slightly lower and more rotated. That was the impression that was at the crime scene. So you immediately compare left to right. Is that characteristic displayed in the opposite footprint? And in this case, it wasn't.
What does that mean?
Asymmetry. So it means the individual's not functioning symmetrically. They are functioning...
Loping.
In a lay term, but it's a much, much more subtle variant that you wouldn't really pick if you were to look at the individual. So that then alters the load and the pressure distributions in the area. Some of the research we did at QUT several years ago, I mapped for the Australian population load distributions across the foot.
Did it mean he was carrying something if there was more pressure on the ball of the foot?
In this particular instance, no. But in previous cases, we have certainly looked at bodies being dragged and the patterns that that produces.
Can you see the twists in his movements from a footprint like that?
Yes, you can. And that's one of the variables that you allow into the assessment. So the foot will elongate in weight-bearing by a known percentage. So all of those variables go into the process.
So, I suppose in all of this, Paul, as you're going through this mental process, the story, the movie that's starting to run in your head is a really grim one.
I don't tend to think of it in terms of a grim one, and I don't visualise it in that way. I'm highly focused on the actual evidence from the crime scene. So I rarely allow myself to get engaged with the external circumstances of the crime. That is horrific.
You have to stay within the puzzle.
Exactly.
Because the circumstances hardly bear thinking about.
Depending on the particular nature of the crime, it's a very fair comment.
What does it feel like, nonetheless, to know that your work helped place a serial killer in jail?
I have actually no feeling about that. It's probably just a sense of obligation. I feel a greater sense of social concern because it is a stressful process to have these calls and get involved. And so I tend to feel more as it's a social obligation to do that work.
Paul, you've got a really interesting way of zoning out through the internet. Tell me how you use the internet to zone out and sort of free your mind up to associate.
I tend to be a very visual person. Visual stimulus is very important to me, hence the Kandinsky, I suppose. And I will go to various parts of the world and look and remind myself of previous life experiences at those webcams. So, for example, I can be looking at a webcam through at Subiaco, where I met my wife, my beautiful wife, Wendy. And it just reminds me of some of the things that she has done for me over my life, looking after our disabled son, Luke, and our daughter, Ruby. And to give you an idea of the kind of stimulus that it invokes is she was kind enough to buy me some new clothes when I went for my interview at the medical school. And she laid out this beautiful shirt and a silk tie and this wonderful pair of boxer shorts. And on them were pictures of beer cans and television sets and all these kind of favourite things. So I put the boxer shorts on and the clothes, and I went to the medical school. And you can imagine going in with three professors behind a mahogany table. And the seat was conveniently located about 10 feet away from the table. And I sat down there and I looked and I crossed my legs and this musical tune started to play from between my legs.
Oh, no!
And Professor Gail Williams peered over the desk and said, "Paul, is that tune coming from between your legs?" I said, "Yes, my wife, Wendy, bought me these musical boxer shorts." I didn't realise there was a pressure sensor in them. Yeah. So that's what the web will do for you.
and you look at these webcams from images from all around Australia, and what do you? How long do you stare at the image for?
Oh, look, it depends. I've had 2 days interviewing students for oral exams in rooms where there are no windows, and I'll set up the data projector behind them so it's projecting on the wall behind them, and I will be doing a trip called Windows to the World. So when we're doing the oral exams, we will have views of Rio, Las Vegas, everywhere, and we change them. So it connects us to the outside world while we do our oral exams.
The subconscious mind's such an interesting thing, I think. It always needs a little matrix to hook onto, or it's a ritual or an image.
Yes.
And something that's familiar to step into, and then that distracts the front of mind process while the back of the mind starts working, spinning, whirring, solving problems or figuring out kinds of things.
Yes, absolutely. It's that analytical process. It's fabulous.
You did some work as a podiatrist for the 2000 Paralympics. Tell me why that was a bit special for you.
The Paralympic movement in Australia and around the world is absolutely fantastic. To see people compete and be accepted in a competing environment and excelling is a really humbling experience. And one quick anecdote was with watching the 800 metres for combined disability, including intellectual disability. And the cohort of athletes took off, and there were 60,000 at Stadium Australia. And the cohort ran around the track, and there was one individual who was clearly lagging behind, and he had both intellectual and physical disability, including cerebral palsy. So he was immediately marginalised from the cohort. Now, that audience, Richard, started to stand as he progressed in front of them. So it became this slow-moving Mexican wave around the entire stadium of Australia. And that gave me great faith and hope that the measure of a good society is its ability to connect with its most vulnerable individuals. And that's why I have great faith for things like the NDIS, the National Disability Insurance Scheme, for the future.
Wow, it's been fascinating to speak with you and just great to get an insight into the way you think and the way you solve these fascinating puzzles. It's been so great to speak. You never did get into bother to apply to Mensa, did you? But nonetheless, you became a problem solver anyway.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for being my guest.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.